507, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. It's always good to be with you, too. I think we've got an interesting accident to talk about today since it's relatively current. And it does bring out a number of issues that John talks about at the end of this show every single time. And it has to start with pre-flight planning. This case involves a newly minted private pilot carrying two passengers that, from what I understand, were his friends, but they both had student pilot certificates and had rented the airplane from the flight school that they were learning to fly at. So, Todd, with that, I'll let you introduce at least the opening part of it, and then we can get into it since you grew up, well, at least you're familiar with the area. That is my home airport on the East Coast. Montgomery County Air Park, where this flight originated from earlier in the day. I know all the flight schools. I know a lot of the players. I've been around that airport, you know, almost 50 plus years. And, you know, it now with the special use airspace after 9/11, there's a lot of things that go into planning a flight. It used to be you could just jump in the airplane and go fly up to Frederick or even near Camp David and over Sugarloaf. And I used to fly both a rented airplane and my airplane down to Ocean City, Maryland, because we had a place down there that I grew up at. And so, I mean, but now there's a lot of special use airspace. So for a newly minted private pilot flying on a long cross country, that's going to involve some nighttime, we have a lot of things to talk about. So why don't you set us up with that, Todd?
Well, we'll start with the accident flight itself. This occurred Saturday night, 20th of June, 2026, roughly 6 days before we're doing this particular recording. So this is before there's a preliminary report from the NTSB. The Piper Archer took off from Ocean City, New Jersey Airport, crossing the a couple of waterways going toward the capital area. And about an hour, 18 minutes later or so, it crashed outside of Gaithersburg, Montgomery County Airport. The circumstances of that are unclear, but some of the initial information that we got from unofficial sources like FlightAware and FlightRadar24, and there's a graphic on the screen right now, indicates that the ground speed of this aircraft was, somewhat variable during its flight from Ocean City to the Washington, D.C. area. And a couple of things that struck us, one of them being, this took off 10 o'clock at night, roughly 10 o'clock at night, and this was after they had been doing some flying during the day. There were several hours that they were on the ground in Ocean City before taking off of the D.C. area. It's unclear what might have been happening during that time, unclear what the reason that they were doing this flight, and that is still under investigation by the NTSB. Unfortunately, all three of the occupants were killed in the crash.
Yeah, and when you look at, you know, at least the data coming out of Ocean City, New Jersey, the ADS-B data would suggest that at some point the pilot, presumably the 26-year-old newly minted private pilot. He hadn't had his license more than about 3 weeks at the time of the accident. There are several circuits in the traffic pattern at the airport. Now, they were, again, based on the ADS-B data, it doesn't suggest that they were full stop. If he was trying to get night current to be legal to carry the two passengers in the aircraft with him, 6157 says that you need to do those landings at night to a full stop. That'll be at least a question to try and answer by the NTSB, going back to Ocean City, New Jersey, seeing if there was an FBO that was open, seeing if these guys had purchased any gas and that kind of thing there, because flight planning is going to be really, I think, a key to this. And we can talk about that here in a second. But like you said, Todd, as soon as they took off, he climbed almost to 9,000 feet. It is an hour plus flight, but I mean, all the times I used to fly down to Ocean City, Maryland from Gaithersburg, I never went to 9,000 feet, maybe 5,000, but never to 9,000. But he wasn't up there very long. And like you said, when you start looking at the ground speed track, that ground speed was all over the place. I can understand the slower speeds in the climb, but once he got up to altitude, those ground speeds varied quite a bit. And then the profile of the flight path is like a dive and drive from 8,000 feet or 9,000 feet down to around 2,000 feet. Once he went over not only the Delaware Bay, but was on the backside of the Chesapeake Bay, he was still quite a distance from Gaithersburg. So there was no real need to dive and drive down that low. But there is the S-free, that is the special use airspace. You do have to have permission to get in there. The pilot would be talking to Potomac TRACON. They would have at least a beat on the aircraft, knowing where it is. And the, one of the questions is, who was he talking to, if anybody? And did he indicate any kind of problem if he was talking to air traffic control or any particular source? Now, again, as you describe, the airplane, as it leveled off at around about 2,000 feet or thereabouts, the ground speed varies. I mean, you're up in the hundreds, and then you're down in the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, back up in the 70s, back up in the 80s. I mean, I don't – some of that, if it's in level flight – maybe there was winds aloft, but I doubt it, because summertime, unless there's a thunderstorm nearby, you're not going to have very strong winds aloft in that area. I grew up there flying in all of that weather. Visibility is always an issue, because at night, with all the haze in the air, and you have a VFR pilot that's navigating presumably by ground references, that makes it difficult. He may have had a GPS. We don't know how the airplane was equipped. But, John, as you always preach, you know, and that is, you know, planning your flight. A lot of these flight schools will rent their aircraft to known students who have learned to fly there, and they have an opportunity to rent an airplane for personal use. This 26-year-old pilot had his private pilot license, so presumably he rented the airplane and took his buddies up to Ocean City, New Jersey for some purpose, and was on the way back. The question is there a separate type of checkout for a pilot like that by the flight school? I mean, because flight training and signing on to receive flight training with a flight instructor is totally different than, okay, now you're going to take one of our airplanes, but you have to meet certain requirements, rental requirements. And if this is the case, and there is a known time that these guys were taking off to the flight school, knowing that they would be coming back at night, did they check night currency? Did they have any procedure or policy that said you got to go up and do three takeoffs and landings to a full stop before we rent you our aircraft, things like that. But the bigger question is, if you're taking an airplane on a long cross country, one, the flight school usually, or the rental agency, depending if it's a flight school or an FBO that rents airplanes, they want to know where you're going. And given the fact that this is a newly minted pilot, did he have to demonstrate to a flight instructor, okay, here's where we're going, this is what we're going to do, here's my flight plan, here's all of the work that goes into conducting a flight like this as part of pre-flight planning? You're preaching all the time, you know, working on it before you even get to the airport, because you know what you're going to do, you know where you're going to go. Was this really planned out?
You know, he left during daylight time, so he probably took these guys with him. I wonder if he arranged for the three landings for night calls in Ocean City, right? And they, because it was a long time in Ocean City.
Yeah.
So he flew around and got night calls while the two guys sat in the coffee shop cooling their heels. And then he got qualified, and then he could fly back. And then you get to the point where I was looking at the timing. It could be that he did some flying by the bridge. You know, the bridges in New Jersey to Delaware are all lit up at night, and it's pretty to look at. You know, if you've never done it before, maybe that was some of what he was doing, climbing around, showing off and showing the sights, you know.
Yeah. And those are black holes, because he came over the Delaware Bay, which is quite a large body of water, and then he had to come over the Chesapeake. So, again, looking at the ADS-B data, he may have been in the area of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge as he crossed over the bay. And then, but he was well south. His flight path was well south of a direct line to Gaithersburg, and that aircraft never really flew a straight line. He wandered quite a bit, not only horizontally on his flight path, but even at altitude, he was up and down, and his ground speeds were all over the place. And again, you know, you have a newly minted private pilot. Just because you get the 3 hours as part of your private pilot training does not mean you are current or proficient at in flying at night. And you have to, by regulation, do 3 takeoffs and landings to full stop to be current to fly passengers. So, I mean, there's a lot of ifs here, you know, or I should say a lot of questions here with regard to whether or not he met those kinds of qualifications. And did the school that rented him the airplane require him to demonstrate that? And then again, I think it gets down to pre-flight planning. A lot of these flight schools, you know, the airplane has fuel on it. How many flights had this airplane gone out on during the day before they took it in the afternoon? Did they start with full tanks? If they didn't start with full tanks, and he's thinking, well, it's going to be an hour and a half up and an hour and a half back. Okay, so that's 3 hours, and I've got 4 hours of fuel. I got enough fuel. When in fact, maybe there wasn't that much fuel on board. Did he do the fuel performance? Because again, a lot of these, especially young people that are, or young pilots that don't know any better, they're flying that fuel that's in the airplane. They may be reluctant to buy fuel on the road. And maybe, depending on the FBO, and that's a question I'd be asking as an investigator, was there an FBO or a self-service pump that could have gotten gas out of Ocean City, New Jersey, but chose not to for whatever reason, thinking they had enough fuel to get back? These are all the kinds of questions, amongst others, that really need answers.
And another thing that I'd question is, what was happening during that day? Now, going by the flight radar 24 information, there were 3 separate flights that day. The first one out of Gaithersburg to Ocean City. Then you had apparently 2 touch and goes and a full stop landing in the pattern at Ocean City. Then the flight back toward the DC area. And collectively, however many hours that was, it makes me question, what kind of fuel calculations did the pilot do? Were they assuming it's going to be like, you know, nice, straight and steady cruise flying for most of the time, and didn't figure in how much more fuel might have been expended given the somewhat erratic nature of especially the airspeed, and also given the choices for what altitude to cruise on, is that something that could have, I'm just speculating here, could the pilot have been not experienced enough to realize that all those extra maneuvers, all those non-standard, at least to you, Greg, non-standard ways of flying to and from in a cross country, could that have worked against him with respect to his fuel state?
Todd, you're recent now coming back into flying. And what happened with your instructor when you went? How much emphasis did he put on the fuel and checking the fuel during the pre-flight, pre-planning and pre-flight?
It was a whole lot of emphasis on that, and in general on flight planning. I didn't get into the plane unless I knew very, very pretty much what we were doing, especially if I was flying alone, where I'm going, why I'm going to be there, what am I going to do, what are my alternatives if I can't make all the objectives in that particular flight, and always mindful of the fact that, hey, there's a certain amount of fuel here. I'm not flying anywhere close to that limit, nor do I have any plans to. And flying in the Bay Area here, there are plenty of alternative airports, so I didn't have to worry about doing a diversion a great distance away from where I was flying. Now, I also didn't fly at night. I flew late in the day sometimes with my instructor, but night flying was not something that was going to happen until the end of the phase of training I was going through. So my question here is, okay, this person, like Greg speculated, was trying to get the touch and goes or the full stop, which he didn't do, apparently, or two touch and goes and one full stop, to be qualified to take his friends back. If that's the case, I'm calling the question the planning. Why would you plan ahead of time to have a joyous, celebratory sort of thing with your friends, your newly minted 3 weeks before, 17 days before? And it's like, oh, by the way, I didn't do the planning ahead of time to get my night qual. So, in the middle of this, while you guys are doing whatever, I'm going to do this thing and be, quote, qualified to fly back at night.
Yeah, and as part of this, once this kind of information really starts to get examined, I'd be going back to the flight instructor who gave this young man flight instruction, and I would definitely be talking to the DPE. I want to know that. I want to see their notes. I want to know how they evaluated this pilot's skills, abilities, and knowledge. We've seen all over the board, we've talked about it on this show numerous times, the fact that just because you have a pilot who holds a pilot's license in their pocket doesn't mean they are ace of the base or worst of the worst. They fall in a very big category there. And you get people that will, okay, I got a license now. I'll do what I, typically or think I should be doing or want to be doing. I don't have, they basically throw caution to the wind. I mean, these are the things that put pilots like this, especially newly minted pilots. We see it in instrument flying all the time. You get somebody that just got a private pilot license and then adds an instrument rating. They fly a technically advanced aircraft like a Cirrus or something and think that because they have a GPS, an autopilot, TAWS, and XM weather or whatever, they're good to go. And then they get themselves in trouble because they don't have the experience. They have the qualification because they hold a certificate in their pocket, but they don't have the real world experience. And flying at night in the Washington area, in that Delmarva area, and trying to utilize, and again, we don't know if he had any kind of GPS, but even if he had a GPS, if you're putting in a direct track from Ocean City, New Jersey, back to Gaithersburg, the flight path on ADS-B is nowhere close to that direct path in any way, shape, or form. But the one thing is, where he went down is in very close proximity to three airports, one being very close, and that's Freeway Airport, which is right off of Route 50. And Route 50 is a heavily traveled highway because that's a main artery between Washington and Annapolis. And then you take Route 50 down to the Chesapeake Bay Bridge to head to the beach. And this is summer, or I think it was, enough summertime where there would have been substantial traffic, either coming or going from the beach, over the weekend. So you have a lot of traffic lights, ground references, but you also have kind of like the mid-air collision where you have all these lights, but you really can't delineate the ground reference that you're looking for if you are using that as your primary source of navigation.
Speaking of summer, looking at the one of my favorite sites, timeanddate.com, it looks like the night of the 20th was the 20th of June, rather, was the longest day of the year in Washington, D.C., and I suspect also in Gaithersburg and Ocean City, New Jersey. So I don't know if that had figured into their planning or maybe their hurry or non-hurry to get back home or get back before sunset, thinking, hey, this is the longest day of the year. We've got all the time.
And that's a good point, Todd, because maybe they were trying to get back while it was still, quote, light, daylight. But, next thing you know, for whatever reason, they aren't taking off until 10 o'clock. And guess what? It is now nighttime.
And sunset that day would have been 8:36 p.m. local time, and aeronautical twilight would end at, 9:06? So if they were landing after 9:06, technically they'd be flying at night.
Hello, aviation enthusiasts, safety professionals, and curious minds. Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. We are thrilled that you dropped by. Here, we dive deep into the world of aviation safety. From incident investigations and technical analysis to lessons learned and what they mean for safer skies. As a member of our channel, you get exclusive member-only perks, first access to new episodes, live stream discussions, and Q&A sessions. We are a community of fellow safety detectives who love aviation as much as you do. If you're passionate about aviation or just curious about how things work, we'd love to have you on board. Hit join, ring the bell to be notified, and jump into the discussions in the comments. Strap in, because together we're going to explore aviation safety like never before. A couple of things that popped up as I was looking at some of the tracks. And one is with three guys on it, we have a thing like graduated driving licenses for kids to get their license when they're 16 or 17 years old, and they can't ride around with their friends until they have their license for a period of time. When I look at those tracks up and down and left and right, like you said, Greg, I wonder if maybe he wasn't the one on the controls, or maybe he was giving them a joyride.
And you bring up a very good point, John, because from my understanding, those two passengers both had student pilot certificates because they were learning to fly out of the same flight school. And it may be he allowed one of them to manipulate the flight controls and fly. Of course, we know that he's not qualified to be giving any kind of instruction, but the regulations don't prohibit a pilot from allowing a non-pilot from wiggling the stick, if you will, that is, manipulating the flight controls, because the pilot in command is the responsible authority for the safe operation of the aircraft.
Let me speculate on that point for a second. He has two passengers. Yep. They're both student pilots, meaning, presumably, all the time they're training, they're in the left seat. However, their friend, the newly minted pilot, is in that left seat, and the student pilot, if he or she were manipulating the controls, is doing so from the right seat. Could that be, what's the technical term for it, discombobulating to that right seat pilot?
Yeah, because it's a whole different sight picture you're using. And again, people don't think about it, But using your left hand when you're sitting in the left seat, that becomes your primary for manipulating the yoke, and because you're using your right hand to push and pull on the throttle and tune radios and all that kind of stuff. But to a novice who has just a student pilot certificate trying to do those things, it is a different sight picture. It is a different tactile feeling flying from the right seat. And so, yeah, you bring up a good point, John, that again, one of the things that I'd be looking at is the control yokes, and then, of course, waiting for the autopsies to come back to see what kind of injuries that the two front seat pilots had sustained, because you can tell a lot from autopsies and, of course, the control yokes. A lot of times, if you have somebody that's on the yoke, they basically, and they know they're going down or something to that effect, or they're holding on for dear life, if you will, because of that death grip when they hit the ground or hit, in this case, trees, they'll snap that yoke horn off. And you can a lot of times tell who was on the flight controls at the time of impact. Looking at the throttle, you normally are flying with your hand on the throttle. Again, if you're sitting in the left seat, the throttle, because it's a push pull, it's on a rod, it tends to bend to the right if from the left seat and bends to the left from the right seat. So there are telltale signs that investigators should be looking at to try and identify who was on the flight controls at the time of impact to try and put this scenario together. And again, looking, we weren't able to find anything on all the various websites that record ATC communications. Not that they don't exist, but it'll be interesting to know whether or not this pilot was in communique. It probably would have been Potomac TRACON, and if he had expressed in any kind of form whether or not they were having an emergency or abnormal situation that they needed assistance with. So these are the kinds of questions that still need answers. Hopefully, when the NTSB puts out the prelim, I would expect soon, we might learn some of this.
It's just, I've been going through a lot of accidents lately looking for material for the show. And man, is it painful to find all these accidents running out of fuel. And it gets just to what you were saying, Todd. They think it has enough on board. They think they're only going to fly for X amount of time. And then they get over that time and they might do some additional takeoffs and burn more fuel than they do. I mean, when I learned to fly, the first thing I did was fill it up. First thing.
Wait. The Wright Flyer did not have fuel tanks, John.
As I was saying that, I knew it was going to come. I just knew. But anyway, there's still an ocean of them running out of gas. And there was one, as I was reading this accident report, there was one other accident report that I went, and I might have to go back and try to find it again now, but there was three people in a Cessna 172, similar circumstances, and the pilot, who was a private pilot but short timer, was letting the other two have turns on the control, and they were changing. The guy in the front seat was going to the back seat, and then the person in the back seat was climbing in the front and got messed up and fell and pushed the yoke over, and they were doing it at low altitude and crashed and killed the three of them. And can't rule any of this out on this one either, because that
Yeah.
last little nosedive that they had could have been something similar.
Yeah. The other thing that I don't think is, I'm the only one that's been talking about it, is that there may have been a second aircraft with these guys, either in the lead or in trail, based on folks that I've talked to, that there may have been two aircraft this, and they had flown to the same place. That may answer the question why they were on the ground for as long as they were. And so that I would expect to be part of the investigation is tracking down whether or not that aircraft had any affiliation with the accident aircraft. And if so, What were they doing? What was the plan? What was the route of flight? What was the discussion? Who was following who? Things like that. So,
and yeah, I think they need to also take a good look at this flight school.
Oh,
because this flight school's got a rather interesting history of accidents.
Yeah, according to our research, they've had multiple accidents over a very short span of time. And it doesn't have to be a fatal, I mean, but it is an accident where, you know, you bend the airplane and the question is why? Is this a systemic issue in the training process? Because I can't believe that the 8 or 9 events that they had were all isolated events for 8 or 9 different reasons. So, you know, looking at it from a trending perspective, and you bring up a good point, John, and that is there a problem with the flight school? Is there a problem with the fact that they teach just enough to be qualified to go for a check ride? And again, if I'm doing an investigation like this, I am all over the flight instructor, and I'm even over the DPE. I want to know what kind of check ride. I want to know how thorough it was. I want to know what this pilot did during the performance of not only his training, but the check ride to demonstrate that he was a safe pilot, because it's obvious 3 weeks later that even though he had that certificate in his pocket, he did something that degraded that operational safety and resulted in an accident that killed 3 people. So, yeah, these are the kinds of accidents that are painful to talk about, only because you have a 26-year-old pilot, and then you have 2 others. One was 18, one was 19. These young people had aspirations. They were probably planning to, you know, make aviation a career. And it's sad that for whatever reason, this airplane having gone down, it took those dreams and aspirations away from 3 young people. And that's the hard part. And I know that one of the things that I had to address when I was talking to local TV about this accident was the fact that for years, people around a lot of the general aviation airports, including Frederick and Gaithersburg, the neighbors are always complaining because there's high intensity flight training going on. There's multiple flight schools at Gaithersburg. There's multiple flight schools at Frederick. And they hate the fact that they got these little airplanes flying over their head day and night and things like that. The problem is that the neighbors really don't understand what airports like Gaithersburg, Frederick, Fort Meade, or whatever, what benefits those airports bring to the community. It's not just people, you know, droning around learning how to fly. You have police, fire, rescue that utilize airports like that. You have the military that utilizes airports like that. You have medical transport flights that utilize airports like that. So they do have a lot of benefit. This airport had nothing to do. None of the airports really had anything to do with this accident. Yet, unfortunately, there has been some chatter because I've been watching it on the internet about, you know, these little airplanes being dangerous. Well, guess what? We're still killing 40,000 people a year in car accidents. So there was one comment I read where they should not allow pilots to fly at night, which is a ridiculous comment. You know, it makes no sense. But if you're going to do that, then you should prevent people from driving at night, because we have a hell of a lot of accidents. So, you know, everything has to be kept in context. This is an unfortunate accident. Hopefully the NTSB will do a thorough and methodical investigation, really get to the bottom of it, and really develop the lessons to be learned so that this flight school may change their way. They may change their policies and their procedures for renting aircraft, even to students, or at least folks that had learned to fly there that they know, they're a known entity, changing their rental policies and that kind of thing. So there's always lessons to be learned, but we just don't have the information necessary right now, since it's this accident's not even a week old, to really come to any kind of conclusion and recommendation.
And I think that takes us straight to the second to last word. And as usually the case, I come up with the second to last word during the show. And what we've been talking about during the show is more than just what happened on the flight. There is a story here that goes beyond what was happening in the air on that particular flight or the other two flights that happened that same day. And I would hope that when the NTSB does do an investigation, that they have supplemental material in that public docket that would explain whatever probable cause is given in the main report. And they do take the time to ask the questions of what were they thinking? What were the circumstances? What were the things that made sense to the investigators, didn't make sense to the investigators, and give us, the aviation community, some insights into preventing these from happening in the future.
And with that, John, that takes us to the last word.
And this discussion we've just had for the last half hour or so just clearly falls into what I've been preaching for 3 years, 4 years, however long this has been going. Pre-planning your flight. It's so damn important. And you've got to do it, and you got to do it twice to make sure that nothing has changed from if you do it at home and then do it again at the airport. And that includes fuel planning. And after you get out to the airplane, a good pre-flight, I'm still finding a lot of accidents where pre-flight has a role to play in the accident. And I've been pulling them aside. I think we're going to be doing a couple of those soon. And, you know, and after you get in the air, you got to put that head on a swivel. Because we've had, I just looked at one accident. And I just looked at it. I haven't gone through it yet. But two airplanes, one with a student on it, they kissed wings right around the airport. And fortunately, they didn't crash. One airplane had a nice chunk out of its wing, but they didn't crash. But I mean, it wasn't bad weather. It was a nice day. You got to put that head on a swivel. You got to look every which way, especially if you have students at the airport, because they're learning. They're going to make mistakes. Don't get involved with their mistake. If you're going to make a mistake, make your own. So please, please fly safely.
Let me talk to the folks who have joined the Flight Safety Detectives, our members. We thank you very much for doing so. And we're hoping that you are enjoying your membership and the benefits that come with that, including getting early access to new episodes and other goodies to be determined later. And if you're interested in becoming a member, you'll see a graphic on the screen with an arrow pointing to the join button on the YouTube channel. Join, do what is necessary to become a member at whatever level you'd like, and enjoy those benefits. And if you have questions, whether or not you're a member or not, write to us at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. And we're not leaving out sponsors. We love sponsors. We can always use more, and we hope that you can use our content to attract our audience to your product or service. Contact us at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. We'll have a conversation.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
For decades, Avemco Insurance Company has been an advocate for pilot safety by promoting and sponsoring continuous pilot training and education. One of their initiatives has been to reward pilots who actively participate in being more proficient with savings on their insurance premium through the Avemco Safety Rewards Program. Pilots save by earning new ratings, getting recurrent training, participating in the Fast Team Wing program, and listening to podcasts like ours and other Avemco-related courses and training. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for an automatic 5% off.